this week's programme, A Life of Frank Duff, founder of the Legion of Mary, one of the leading international Catholic lay organisations of the 20th century. It's written by Finola Kennedy, who's an economist and lifelong member of the Legion. Frank Duff spent 26 years in the civil service before devoting himself full-time to Legion work in 1934. It's hard to believe now that in the 1920s and early 1930s, the Legion was perceived by church authorities in Ireland as a threat. Set up in 1921, it didn't have Dublin diocesan approval until 1935. The Frank Duff who emerges in Dr. Kennedy's biography is a civil servant turned entrepreneur, a good listener, who was inspired by his Catholic faith, but wary of certain manifestations of it. For example, he told someone in the mid-1970s that the Catholic world had gone mad on the subject of apparitions. With me, Dr. Lindsay Erna-Byrne of the History Department at UCD, Charles Lycett, who's a lawyer, biographer and journalist, and Patsy McGarry, religious affairs correspondent with the Irish Times. Here's the voice of Frank Duff, recorded in 1968 for a commercial disc in New Jersey. He's giving a talk on Idel Quinn, another legionary.
When I search my mind for something comprehensive to say about her, the thought comes to me that she is an embodiment in all its details of the Catholicism which has been proposed to us by the recent Great Council. It would not do that people should regard the Council as talking in terms of unrealizable theory. Therefore, it is absolutely necessary to exhibit to the world examples of the theory reduced to heroic and refreshing practice.
Frank Duff talking about Idel Quinn. That was recorded in 1968. Lindsay Erna-Byrne, what do you think of this book by Finola Kennedy?
Well, it's certainly a book that will place Frank Duff decidedly on the map. I think it paints such a detailed and varied picture of this life, which stretched for 91 years, and how it was integrated in a time as well through history and the role he played. It's a very easy to read book and a very informative book. It's quite scholastic, so it's written from a very religious perspective, and there is a certain assumption that that religious perspective might be shared by the reader. But it's incredibly interesting, and very interesting at this juncture as well for us to reflect back on the history of the Roman Catholic Church in Ireland and the very meaning of that idea, church, which in this, through the life of Frank Duff and particularly the way Kennedy tells it, is so much more than hierarchy, so much more even than priests. But it's about the interaction, I suppose, between the laity and even quite apart from Catholic action, which I think there's a certain awareness of. Frank Duff is yet again apart from that. And I think what Kennedy does is uses Frank Duff's life to explore just how complex that church was and the degree to which it was integrated with its society.
Charles Lycett, can we hear you on Finola Kennedy's book?
I think the triumph of the book, really, it's interesting in the background, but the triumph of the book is that it keeps Frank Duff central. And all good biography must do that. The subject must be central. You mustn't lose the person in the many activities. And I think that's where she has done very well. And also, of course, she has really corrected an image people might vaguely have had of him as a kind of pious holy Joe of rather conservative views. You know, I suppose taking an image the Legion of Mary possibly has and transferring it to him. So she has provided a picture of a man which goes against whatever stereotype existed about what kind of man he was.
Patsy McGarry.
Well, that is a very interesting observation made by Charles there, because that's precisely the attitude I would have had to Frank Duff as something of a fuddy-duddy conservative, really about saving his own soul. And the man that comes through these pages is quite a different, quite a radical figure, a revolutionary in the terms of his own time, a man who was ahead of his time in terms of his perception of the role of the laity in the church, but also in his attitude, particularly to unmarried mothers. He set up the hostel, the Regina Chaley Hostel, so that an unmarried mother could keep and rear her child, and thousands of children were reared in that hostel. I mean, the conditions were not easy or whatever. He also set up a separate home for prostitutes that had been in Monto to help them to get out of that way of life, and for homeless men. But apart from that, his attitude to Protestants, through his attempts through the Mercier Society to reach out to them, his attitude to Jews, through the Pillar of Fire Society, they're utterly a revelation to me, which predated the Vatican II by decades in their progressiveness. So I must confess that I was quite taken by the book, and I wouldn't have read it for, well, I know Fionnuala Kennedy, and that's a privilege in itself, but also...
Why would you have read it? Because
I would have had that perception. I did have that perception that Charles referred to.
As a fuddy-duddy.
Quite.
Lindsay, the interesting thing is the attitude of the church that, you know, they didn't give him recognition for a long time. And as I say, it's hard to believe now that in the 20s and 30s they would have perceived the Legion of Mary as a threat of some kind.
It is. It's extraordinary. I think probably many people will be surprised at that. And I think Fionnuala does a wonderful job of explaining why that was. And I think it's in a phrase that she quotes from Duff late towards the end of the book, where she refers to Duff's description of faith as action. And that unnerved a rather stagnant hierarchy that didn't want the laity taking into their own hands the notion of how that faith should be practiced. And you can see it quite clearly in his relationship, for example, with Archbishop Byrne in the 1920s, where Byrne actually refuses to meet with him. He meets the Pope before he meets Byrne. Byrne is frightened of any lay initiative. He thinks that it might compete with the role of the priests. It might distract from the way, the sort of hierarchical nature of that relationship between those members of sodalities, for example, and parishioners.
The Archdiocese in 1960 was as recently as that, in fact. I mean, the Legion goes back to 1921, was asked to look at the fact that they had great difficulty in getting priest spiritual directors. And this document was prepared for the Archdiocese. And it was very frank in its attitudes to the Legion. And it says, for instance, those priests among the ranks of the senior clergy regard the entire movement of the Legion of Mary as a subtle and very subversive intrusion into their professional work, which work, if they cannot do themselves, they consider should be left undone. So they saw it, the Legion and its work, as encroaching on the territory of the clergy. And Archbishop Byrne in particular had that perception. Now, there may have been other factors. Archbishop Byrne didn't like the fact that they went into Monto, certainly without consulting him. He had served in the pro-cathedral. It was his parish before he became bishop.
It's very interesting to read about the Mercier Society, which is about dialogue between Catholics and Protestants. And Dr. McQuaid was opposed to lectures by Protestants. And in other words, he was very, very uneasy about... that they would be giving that kind of free reign.
Couldn't state their point of view. They were certainly very extreme on that. And but you know, he was really quite conservative, Frank Duff, even on the talking about taking over the clergy role. I mean, the Legion of Mary is subservient to the priests; they are the foot soldiers. I wonder if they weren't a bit suspicious of this bachelor taking an interest in prostitutes. You know, I'd say that was
I think Charles is, as they say, on the money here, because I really believe the problem is that for all of his splendid action and how adventurous he was, especially in terms of the international expansion, that he did have a clericalist conception of the church. I mean,
he was very subservient, and McQuaid congratulated him in the latter part of their relationship on his subservience.
But that's why
on his docility.
Exactly, and that's the word he used.
Let me quote that, Lindsay, where he says, McQuaid writing to the Secretary of State, to Cardinal Cicognani, the attitude of the Legion to the bishop's authority is uniformly submissive. So here's my point. It seems to me that the row in the early period between McQuaid, between the official church, and Frank Duff occludes the fact that he did see that he did have a clericalist conception of the church, by which he means that the laity were in a subservient
role. And he was deeply hurt by that lack of vision for that reason.
Duff himself, by Byrne,
what he saw as a rejection. Couldn't fathom it precisely for that reason.
Because he saw we were all on one side.
He sort of felt like the apostolate, as he saw it, the lay activity, as he saw it, was to complement what the priests did, but absolutely to take direction from those priests. I think there's another agenda too here. Duff put this stuff on the radar, because he wrote a series about Bentley Place. So he was actually, and Byrne and McQuaid, certainly McQuaid, didn't want negative publicity of that nature about his diocese.
Yes.
And so that was part of the reason.
Bentley Place being Monto.
The references to prostitution and so on, and to the level of poverty. This was something that while the church was dealing with it on various different fronts, and they were, what Duff was doing was sort of putting this on the public agenda. I mean, there's that wonderful description of his meeting in July 1922 in the middle of the Civil War in Marion Buildings. Conference with Cosgrave, yeah, president of the Free State, the executive council of the Free State, where he tells him about the prostitutes, the situation in inner city Dublin, and he's given 76 Harcourt Street to set up his hostel to rescue these women and provide them with retreats and so on. So I think it was that Duff, because of his civil service background, because of his vision and his courage and his dedication to
his relationship with Cosgrave was actually quite fascinating. Cosgrave, this is the original William.
What did that tell you? What did you learn from that?
Well, I mean, Cosgrave, first of all, his devotion as a Catholic was unequivocal. But also, I mean, Cosgrave would have been aware, I expect, that Archbishop Byrne didn't really have much time for the Legion at that stage. Yet Cosgrave was very supportive of Frank Duff right the way through and arranged for his first meeting with Pius XI.
Do you agree, Charles, that Frank Duff's civil service career, as Fionnuala says, has been consigned to oblivion?
Well, until now. Mm. And it's the most interesting study is his whole years in the civil service. And what
26 years in all, yes.
26 years and the very useful work he did, and Fionnuala's husband, Kieran, did research on all the files. It was a wonderful work because it illuminates his personality as well as everything else, as well as the issues he was in. You know, wonderful thing about Fionnuala, he's her godfather, she's thrilled to the subject, and yet she hasn't whitewashed them. That's the great triumph of this book. Now, Lona Brin wrote a biography of him before this, and it was far too much of a whitewash, pious and so on. Fionnuala brings out, you know, there's the man, like all civil servants, grumbling about not being promoted. All civil servants, they generally have that.
Do you agree with her that he successfully combined a life in the civil service with those kind of part-time work he was doing in the Legion?
Which he was challenged about by Paddy Hogan in particular. He had also, what comes through, is his sense of grievance at the way he was treated in the civil service itself, by being overlooked for promotion, by the fact that suddenly men with degrees were being brought in and he hadn't a degree, and suddenly being promoted over his head. But I thought the Fionnuala's chapter or section dealing with his work on the 1923 Land Act was fascinating. In fact, I thought her whole observations on the various land acts, the Wyndham and Birrell and Balfour acts, was just very...
Well, that's what's so good, I think, about her, Patsy, you've just got, is her grasp of the background. Yes. It's a wonderful portrait, really, of the Dublin of his time and the Dublin he moved in. That's one of its values, I think, as a book.
I don't think she quite sustains her claim that he was a thinker. I mean, I don't think, unless she means it in a very specific way in terms of coming up with practical ideas and so on, but
she does make the difference, he does, that what matters is virtue, not knowledge.
Yes, that's quite central to him, isn't it?
Very much to his type of spirituality. Yeah. So, and the people he dealt with.
She does use the word thinker more than once about him, which I think isn't fully sustained.
I would agree there, absolutely.
The entrepreneurial nature is.
Yeah. The entrepreneurial nature is. Yeah. Something in aviation, did he have some...
He had all sorts of ideas. And he was also asked in the late 1940s, 1950s to sort of review what Ireland means.
Oh, cheap flights, I believe.
Ryanair model. She actually says that. because, of course, his big triumph with the Legion, recognised abroad long before it was at home, was that he managed to facilitate that organisation and its ideas to spread far beyond the shores of Ireland, using envoys like Adele Quinn and so on. And so he sort of had this international conglomerate, if you like,
there are 10 million 30s. People affiliated to it around the world today.
It's the original Irish multinational.
It's extraordinary.
It's a huge
But on that point, Andy, about the intellectual versus the virtuous, and I thought this is very revealing of Pope Paul VI rather than the Legion of Mary. He refers, Pope Paul VI remarked that what he liked best about the Legion was that it knew how to utilise the little people of the world.
Yeah.
God, I find that very pejorative.
Absolutely.
That it was for people who were non-intellectual, if you like. And Duff,
which is not the way Duff saw it at all. I think his reflections on the way in which religion is practised in Ireland is very interesting. He refers to it not being a social religion, and that it was one more of form and ritual than it was of practical action.
He began in the Vincent de Paul. Did that last long? Did he spend long with the Vincent de Paul fair number of years, because the Legion was, what, 1921?
1921.
So 12 years, I think, isn't it?
Yes.
Well, from about 19... the interesting thing about him is, when you ask that question, is there is no sign of this very committed religious person until he's about 24 years of age. Mm. He comes from a background that's notable by not being religious.
And its absence of clergy.
And his and absence of clergy.
And Catholics and Protestants in that background.
That's right.
Which is very interesting. Yeah. I was most surprised,
he's
think,
a strange,
by his background.
He's a strange figure, in a way, in view of his background. Mm. And then he sort of becomes driven. There's no doubt he was a driven person. Yeah.
And ambitious.
You know, I think that, returning to Lindsay's point earlier on about his view of religion at the time in Ireland, I think it has strong resonances today, where the church talks about the privatisation of religion. But yeah, I think it was a very privatised religion. And if he says that religion, this is back in the early part of the 20th century, religion was being understood and practiced only in an individual way without sufficient awareness and commitment to the responsibility each member of the church bore for his or her fellow members. While Christianity was the chief boast in Ireland at the time, it was a Christianity that was understood and practiced only in a partial sense as an individualistic religion whereby one beautifies and saves one's own soul.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, that was privatised religion as much as it is today. And today it's criticised by the church.
So to that degree, he was quite revolutionary in that era.
He really believed there must be a public or a social dimension.
Well, he was quite critical of it.
Religion was very private. His opting for celibacy on grounds of economic necessity.
I think that you can see the outlook. I always think the clergy have more faith in married men. They like lay people to be respectable married men.
Bachelors presume that married men are respectable.
Bachelors could be footloose figures, I think. But it's strange family setup, really, when you think of it, to the modern eye. The two boys living with their mother into middle age, his brother John, the secretary of the head of the Department of Justice, and himself, live into middle age with the mother.
But there were reasons for that too, as Fionnuala makes clear, Charles. Financial reasons. His father got cancer and had to retire very early, shortly after he started in the civil service in 1908. So he became the chief provider. And then he had to educate his rest of his siblings.
That was unusual at the time, and I think Fionnuala does make that reference. And that's where, as you said, Charles, her grasp on the sort of historical context is so valuable in this book, because she does talk about the level of celibacy, and also it goes back to the sense of responsibility about the family, which would have been very strong, and which motivated the reason why he didn't go into university. And he did, I think that was an issue for him, certainly within his career in the civil service. I think he felt
I was interested he advocated what Fionnuala calls societizing, that is to say, the bringing into being of societies for people who were not prepared to take the step of Legion membership. Unrealth was one of those, which in my younger days was a very well-known organisation. This was the Legion of Mary through Irish, was
that's
that
right.
it? Patsy, tell me about it.
Well, I mean, it was in the latter part of his life, anyhow. He actually tended to branch, he diversified, to use a business term, into all the Legion into all these other areas, like the Irish language being one, the Mercier Society being another attempt, which was knocked on the head by Archbishop McQuaid, the Pillars of Fire Society.
Imperial ambition.
Well, indeed. Entrepreneurial was the word and it's absolutely accurate. I mean, he had a very active imagination from a business point of view, and he had quite an entrepreneurial approach. But to come back to the business of the family, and he had a very close relationship with his mother, who was, of course, utterly dependent upon him financially. A quite a formidable woman in her own right, very, very well educated, very, very well read. I would say a very strong figure in that home.
But not very religious.
Not very religious at all.
She said the house at one point, Fionnuala sides were saying, house is full of religious books, I could never read one of them. Back to what Charles was saying, it does seem that his religious formation was very much his own.
It must be highly unusual, though, not having a kind of supportive mother in that respect.
I wonder if that's part of the reason why his particular approach to the practice of his religion was so different. Was because, in a sense, it wasn't informed by a pro rata, everyone else is doing it, a familial sense of religiosity and practice of my religion. He actually had to come to it himself. And Fionnuala, because I would, in her own very deep understanding of Roman Catholic theology and how it works and functions, and that comes through the text quite a lot, seems to be able to track exactly the pivotal moments, relationship with Gabbett, his involvement in the St. Vincent de Paul and later pioneers, but his reading of the devotion. That really had a huge influence on him.
He was absent from the list the first list of lay invitees to the Vatican, to the Second Vatican Council. My own view is he didn't get Vatican II. Who did, says you? I mean, if a lot of the bishops and the clergy didn't, then it was no surprise that he didn't.
Some of them did. I mean, there is a certain sense of when you talked about he not being on the first list, of his disappointment at that, mm-hmm. as related by Fionnuala. But he was invited, as you know, later on. And I think that his own influence through Cardinal Suenens particularly, and yes. indeed Cardinal Heenan, on Vatican II's mm-hmm. attitude to the laity was quite profound.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
And when he arrived there, I mean, in 1965, as Fionnuala records it, Cardinal Heenan was actually speaking, stopped, introduced him, and he got a standing ovation from the Bishop of the World, which is
sure,
a huge
but nonetheless, though, his response to Heenan was, from the very first moment, the Legion has asserted that it aspires to be the handmaid of the priest.
Oh,
that's
absolutely.
Deeply preconciliar thinking.
Without a doubt, and in that sense, he was quite traditional in his attitude to authority of the church.
But in fairness to him, in fairness to Duff, I mean, how many grasped the real shift that occurred in Vatican II? I mean, I think that's
certainly
that's
Archbishop McQuaid didn't.
Remind us of what he said. Something that there's nothing there to disturb
to trouble
your tranquil life.
You will have heard a lot about change, but it's nothing for you to worry about.
The relationship with McQuaid is a wonderful thing.
Oh, God,
that's one of the great chapters.
Isn't it wonderful?
And
absolutely.
It's the wonderful thing that so often in life he was intriguing to an extent for McQuaid's appointment.
Yes.
Putting a word in and
to
with the papal nuncio and so on.
The
and then, of course, when McQuaid comes in, he asserts his authority over him
and quite vigorously
slaps him down boldly a few times. Yes.
There's a marvellous quote from Father Edmund Lean, who was a distinguished Holy Ghost father of the time, and I think he's talking about John Charles, that he believed, John Charles, that is, that society should concern itself solely with those non-Catholics who come for instruction without any controversial intent. We'll talk about that earlier. This was the Mercia Society, wasn't it?
Which he basically suppressed.
But then that was very much of its era.
But that's an interesting area of the Legion that people might want to look further at is, you know, the Legion is trying to recruit Catholics. To a degree, some people could see it as proselytizing body. And a lot of people would even have difficulty about that nowadays.
Lindsay, you're quoted in the book in that context. Let me just clarify for our listeners that if I remember, you're quoted in the context of both sides being at it, as it were, both proselytizing it.
Yeah, I mean, I think they would have that's actually Jacinta Prunty who refers to it as spiritual warfare towards the end of the 19th and early 20th century. And I think this idea of proselytism, which is that charity is given for conversion to one or other faith. And certainly I think the Legion of Mary would have seen itself as a counter-proselytizing organisation. In other words, they were sort of going into areas like the brothels within Dublin, in Dublin's inner city, the unmarried mothers as well. Yeah. Of course, the great fear about unmarried mothers, and Duffin makes no secret about that being a motivating fact, is that is that unmarried mothers would have been susceptible, if you like, to Protestant aid. Catholic unmarried mothers that were not given another option may well have gone to Protestant homes, and therefore their children would have been raised as Protestants. And that was a great fear. That's the one thing that you could get McQuaid's response on very quickly,
In your opening remarks, Lindsay, you said something I found very interesting that about the kind of assumptions that Fionnuala was making about her reader. I mean, what kind of assumptions can she make today about readers?
I do think she does assume her reader is pretty well informed in Catholic theology. And scholasticism, to use Lindsay's word from earlier on. That could be.
But is that a reasonable assumption? I mean, what do we know in terms of what. Well, Lindsay,
I think it's a pity that there isn't a greater note of distance in that sense, because I think it would have reached a wider audience. However, I still find it absolutely fascinating, but it is quite definitely a life written within the Roman Catholic tradition.
Oh, sure. I mean, certainly, for example, reading it, I hadn't thought about what you said. I mean, I took it up and I'm totally familiar with many of the contexts that arise here.
But I'm thinking,
maybe that's not true for many, many people, especially for younger people.
Yeah. I think there is an element of, I wondered about that, whether there's an assumption that these values are shared. Mm. There's certainly an assumption that one has an understanding of what's meant by the nature of being apostolic, for example.
Yes.
And sometimes I think just a little bit greater distance would probably have served better in terms of
in other
biography.
Words, there are things she can't take for granted.
But also that there isn't an assumption that those values are shared as well.
Yes, right.
You know,
right.
On the other hand, I think there's some very valuable insights.
There absolutely
are.
Oh, absolutely.
And the whole issue of attitude to Protestants or ecumenism, I think she makes one very interesting observation, which is resonance for this day and for the debate about education going on. She said that Duff and McQuaid held distinct views in ecumenism. The background of the two men is important in understanding the different approaches. McQuaid was born in Quitehill, County Cavan, a border county. He would have been conscious of the prayer in the Mass for the ordination of priests, which then referred to those who did not accept the full deposit of faith as heretics and schismatics. Both Duff's father and mother had attended a state model school, where different Christian denominations were educated together, and Duff supported an environment in which Catholics and non-Catholics could meet on a neutral ground and strive for mutual understanding, which really is what the Mercier Society was about. McQuaid's perception of the Mercier Society was utterly different.
It must be said that the, as Fanoda brings out, Stanford and his friends who were in it did see the Mercier Society as one for converting, possibly converting them. But I suppose the difference with Duff was he hoped that people would be attracted by the way of life of people in the Legion, not by hard sells and forcing people.
By witness.
In the way he had come to it.
Yes.
I mean, I think it's significant, Annie, that this book was launched by the current Archbishop of Dublin, considering the history that Frank Duff had with Archbishop Byrne and Archbishop McQuaid. So really it has come almost full circle. Where the Irish Church is concerned anyhow, where the Legion of Mary is concerned, it's no longer out there.
And the level of research that's in this book is outstanding. And she mentions at one point that he has a collection of 33,000 letters.
Yes.
Five people have read them or
something. She has a way of bringing in the history, the social history, the economic history, weaving it together.
That's
so fascinating.
We've been discussing Frank Duff, A Life Story by Fionnuala Kennedy, published by Continuum. My thanks to Lindsay Erna-Byrne, Patsy McGarry and Charles Lysett. You can listen to the programme again on our off-the-shelf website at rte.ie. Till next week, bye-bye.